This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
In addition to a judicial nominee came out against Roberts last week, spokesman Hillary Shelton says Roberts goes against the mainstream with his support of an effects test for voting rights.
You have to be able to prove that someone actually intended to discriminate against voters before the Voting Rights Act will be fully implemented, or whether indeed the effect of the process of voting in a particular area that ends up leaving very specifically African Americans out of the equation of being able to register or being able to cast an unfettered vote and have that vote counted.
But Tom Fitton of the conservative group Judicial Watch says Roberts is simply making sure the law is clear as to what constitutes discrimination.
You just can't say because something may impact someone negatively makes it necessary for the federal government to implement voting rights procedures at the state and local level.
Even though the hearings on Roberts' nomination will start 6 days later than first planned as a result of Rehnquist's death, Senate leaders were optimistic that a vote on Roberts would take place before the Supreme Court term begins October 3rd. Democrats, who had indicated they were unlikely to try to block Roberts' confirmation, said the proposal to make him Chief Justice raised the stakes. Well, Delta Airlines, Inc. expects...
And you're listening to Pacifica Headline News with Verna Avery Brown and Sidrek Franklin and Leanne Caldwell. We're running out of time now. As a matter of fact, it's 101 in New York City, and you're tuned to WBAI, WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Atti.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. What happened to our theme? Hey, we're bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Roberta. Hi there.
Hi, Armand.
Surprised you with that one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Today we're going to talk about some of the things that are happening in society and some of the things that are happening in the common psychology of the human mind. First, I want to go to an article an article by Nicholas Kristof, who was in the New York Times, who pointed out some of the things that are happening as a result of the Louisiana disaster. Things have come to our attention that there's a growing number of Americans who are caught in the cyclone of poverty, and that the poverty rate rose again last year, with 1.1 million more Americans living in poverty in 2004 than a year earlier. That's 1.1 million more. After declining under the previous administration, the number of poor people has now risen 17% in a few years. Infant mortality rate in America's capital is twice as high as in China's capital, Beijing. The number of babies who died before their first birth mounted to 11.5 per thousand in Washington, D.C., compared with 4.6 in Beijing. According to the United Nations Development Program, an African-American baby in Washington, D.C. has less chance of surviving its first year than a baby born in the urban parts of the states in India. Hmm. So the national infant mortality rate, with all the medicine we have, has risen for the first time in 1958, the very first time since 1958. Another important disappointment with the way we deal with disasters and catastrophes is the looting. Looting, people looting. Around the world, there is not that much looting when there's a disaster. You know, in Kobe, Japan, there was an earthquake that killed 5,500 people, And there was no thought of looting. The only looters were people who were not Japanese, because they were kind of related, because they are connected, because there's a kind of a consciousness that connects you. So one of the things that I want to look at today was, how is it that we could look at and see and have these things exist all around us? And what are the things, what makes us feel okay?
When you're saying they were connected in Japan, Armand, what I understand, what I hear you say, is there is a sense of familiarity with the people in your surroundings, even if you don't know them, but they're your neighbors. And so you treat them like family in a catastrophe.
Meaning that
you feel them like family. So you would never think of looting or hurting them or taking advantage of the fact that they've been hurt by the catastrophe. So when you're saying connected, I just want to make sure I understand what you mean. I think you mean to say that they are familiar, that they're like family.
Well, it's a good word, familiar, you know, Roberta, because when I think about it, I don't find fault with the people who were doing the looting, because they were doing the looting from the stores that had anything available that could help keep them alive while they were starving, on one hand, but then they were looting from each other as well. See, it turned into that kind of thing where it's like, now me and my babies have to survive, and if I've got to take the food out of your baby's mouth, I will do that. Now, that means something to me. That means that the mind is doing something, and I wanted to look at the national mind. I wanted to look at all of our minds, and to that, today we're going to investigate a concept called compartmentalization. It's a big word.
It's a big word, yes.
Compartmentalization. Compartmental?
Compartment means a section of something.
Right. Mentalization means to do it with your mind. Where do we get this ability to compartmentalize things like the war in Iraq, the elections, the disasters, the tsunami, the thing in Louisiana, you know, the...
Every time I walk by a homeless person, I compartmentalize. I have to.
There's a place in your brain that compartmentalizes, and we want to talk about that today. We want to talk about the national compartmentalization, and that this is not all wrong. It is very natural to do this. Where does it come from, Roberta?
It comes from the need to decrease discomfort, to maintain the capacity to cope with day-to-day necessities. It comes from the need to protect ourselves from things that we feel we have no control over, things we feel we cannot fix. And so compartmentalization allows us to take this thing, the thing we are not able to deal with, we feel we're incapable of fixing it, we take it and we put it aside. We put it in a place of our minds and bodies, out of access, out of reach from the rest of us, so that the rest of us can continue to function.
Well, don't we do that with our body? I mean, if you're a hunter,
right.
If you're a hunter, I mean, a tiger is running around and it gets hurt. Doesn't it compartmentalize?
Absolutely. You have to compartmentalize. I was just reading, when was it, doing the research for this program, I was reading the story of a man who had to cut off his own leg in order to survive. I think he had something fell on him and he was in the woods by himself and he cut off his own leg. Now, in order to do that, he had to compartmentalize his bodily sensations and his ability to withstand pain, terror, despair. I mean, he had to be able to take whatever he needed to do to survive. He took that and he put it in a place other than the rest of himself so that he could do it.
In his mind he did that. In his mind he
did
that.
In his mind he did that. And in his body.
All right, so let's talk about how we do it.
And in his body too.
Sure.
Because in order to cut off your own leg, you need to be able to numb yourself, for instance. And in order to numb yourself, your nervous system has to produce a larger than usual amount of certain neurotransmitters, like opiates, for instance, so you don't feel that pain that would prevent you from being able to cut off your leg.
So if you're in a disaster and you're facing a problem and things have fallen down around you and you have a great amount of job stress and you don't know what to do and your poor mind is working overtime and it's very alert and you become very nervous. Now we're going to talk about anxiety in a couple of minutes. You get into anxiety and you feel this anxiety and the anxiety begins to build in you because you're nervous. You have to be able to numb a part of you. You have to be able to segment, to take whatever it is and put it into a convenient place. Put the awareness in a convenient place. So the body will do this if, let's say, you hurt your hand and you were trying to function and you had to get through the day and you had to go rush and find your babies because you were afraid they were in trouble. Your hand would go numb. You would cut off circulation to your hand so that you didn't feel it. You would cut off the sensors. And your hand doesn't become a part of you anymore. Just as if you're trying to run somewhere to save your babies, you see somebody else who's in deep trouble, you've got to put them in a spot in your mind. You have to find a little compartment and say, I can't save that person, I have to save my babies, so you don't feel the pain of the moral conflict of having to save someone else's life.
So it's a survival strategy that it's activated.
And it's one of the common ones. It's one of the ones that we have in our body. Now, I think what's interesting about compartmentalization is that the body is so used to doing it that many people will take a discomfort. Like, let's say you're being beaten in childhood and you get hurt. You will actually take that part of your body and shut off the hurt.
Well, and you could go even further than that. I mean, you're an expert in this, Armand. You could even develop an alternate self that deals with the pain of the beating so that you don't have to. And all of that pain is felt only by that extra self.
That's a really much bigger conversation.
It's a bigger conversation, but it's kind of along the same lines.
For sure.
We're able to compartmentalize to the point of dissociating and splitting up into two different people in the same body, if necessary, in order to survive an extremely traumatic event that would otherwise overwhelm us to the point of maybe even death.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Mariotti. We're talking about compartmentalization, and we're talking about it as a social reaction as well as a physiological reaction. If you have some situation where you have a tremendous pain in childhood, let's say hunger, and you can disconnect from the hunger. Now, here's the issue here. The issue is that if you compartmentalize, it has the potential for explosion. And I know you're going to love this, Roberta, but I'm going to say that if you compartmentalize a part of your body as a child, that is going to become the focus of your illness in your adulthood. Because eventually, it begins to take a life of its own.
Absolutely. I agree with you. When we compartmentalize, we need to begin with the chemistry of it. And what we do is, for instance, we secrete more cortisol. Cortisol has an effect on the brain, allows the brain to take a part of itself and separate it from the rest of itself, truly to the point where the neurons, the brain cells that are normally connected to one another, those connections break up. And so that there's now a part of the brain that is totally separate from the rest of the brain. And of course, the brain is connected to the body, so that part is connected now to a part of the body.
A great example of this is one of the forms of cortisol is steroids. Human steroids, when people take steroids. One of the things about taking steroids is that you can actually compartmentalize your muscles and you build this muscle mass separate from the needs of the body. And you find these very unusual-looking muscle men who have built these enormous muscles that don't have anything to do with the human body. A compartmentalized part of the body will take on a life of its own. And that's where, I mean...
And the thing is that in order to compartmentalize, both in the mind and in the body, what the brain needs to do is separate physically and emotionally a part of the self, so that now you have this independent part. The longer this goes on, the more separate this part becomes, and the more independent it becomes. So that you're right, Armand. Later on, when eventually it catches up, because it can't be kept separate forever, it usually becomes the focus of pathology, of illness, because that's where all the unwanted stuff goes. Since it's detached from the rest of us, we might as well throw all the garbage there, all the stuff that we don't want to feel, we don't want to think, we don't want to be aware of. It all goes there. Now, but it is still connected to the sensorial apparatus, the eyes, the ears, the skin. So sometimes there could be a trigger, like something visual that I see, that reconnects that part enough that now it comes flooding in.
An example. Good example. How do you, as a person, in living in the Middle East, living in Afghanistan, living in Iraq, living in Israel and Palestine, how do you deal with the constant awareness that at any moment there's going to be a suicide bomber who could be sitting somewhere right next to you, and they could blow you up and blow up your family? How do you deal with that? In order to get through the day, you compartmentalize. What you do is you do something with your mind to put that danger somewhere in the background, not in the foreground. But like Roberta is saying, it is active, even though it's dormant. And then, on a bridge, during a religious ceremony, a group of people hear the word suicide bomber, and hundreds of people are killed by the stampede that comes from the compartment all exploding in everybody at the same time. That whole panic was about compartmentalization. Though all of the deaths on the bridge in Iraq was all about the fact that we suppressed it for so long. Look at us here in the country. I remember once, right after 9/11, we were in a movie theater. And in the movie theater, you know, everybody's sitting and watching a movie, and the movie attendant or somebody comes in and says, "Will everybody please exit the theater immediately?" Now, here we are watching this rather quiet movie, and this person just stands in the back, which says, "Would everybody please exit the theater immediately?" It was like it was dormant. Awareness was dormant. Everybody stood up rapidly and went to the exits. Not anyone turned around and says, "Why? Who are you? Who's asking this?" No, it was in the latency. So here we have in two parts. We have it in the human body, and we have it in our social consciousness. This whole idea.
Well, because one thing that happens in compartmentalization is that in order to compartmentalize, the mind and the body need to suspend normal activity. For instance, pertaining to the mind, logic, rationality, are suspended in the compartmentalization dynamic, so that the part that is compartmentalized does not follow a logic or a rationality like the rest of the mind. Therefore, when there is a trigger like that, which could be a hairpin, it could be a minor thing, all of the chemicals in the body that have been withheld, kept at bay, isolated, not allowed to flow into the compartmentalized piece of self, now come rushing in at a speed and with an intensity that is abnormal for the situation. So you have an abnormal reaction. And as Armand just described, you have a stampede. You have something that goes against normal logic, normal reactive behavior, because it has been held at bay for so long and controlled for so long.
Is that why, Roberta, very often one illness that will debilitate somebody will suddenly be followed by a flood of illnesses?
Sure, because now that you've opened that one small passage, the whole river comes flooding in, and because it has been dammed up for so long, it has a force that normally it wouldn't have. So
one of the biggest areas of compartmentalization involves cigarette smoking. I'd like to talk about that. Cigarette smokers tend to use compartmentalization more than the average folk. So if you want to say what are the different defenses that people use, one of, you know, they could call them denial, displacement, intellectualizing, projection. There are a whole bunch of them. A cigarette smoker tends to compartmentalize. Just think about it. They love to smoke. They have this nicotine addiction. They put in their mind the danger, and they separate it from themselves. But now, in addition to that, when a cigarette smoker stops smoking, they get flooded with physical illnesses because the nicotine seems to facilitate compartmentalizing of a lot of physiological symptoms as well. I'm sure you've dealt with that.
Well, and I think you're describing a dynamic that happens a lot with all addictions, because in addiction, with an addiction, what the brain does is to compartmentalize reality and to separate the addiction from the reality so that the two don't join, don't communicate, so that reality with its facts against addiction doesn't take away the justifications for the addiction, so you keep them separate. But once you remove the addiction, all of the things that the addiction protected the person from, all of the reality that the addiction was a shield for, including the physical reality, comes rushing in. That's exactly what we were describing.
And so when you see somebody resisting giving up an addiction, sometimes there's a foreknowledge, there's a greater knowledge in the brain that says, but if we give up this addiction, we may fall apart.
Yes.
And the truth is, you may.
You may, right.
You very well may. And part of addiction curing is being able to fall apart.
Without dying.
Right. And but knowing, expecting you to fall apart is a big part. That's why I think, you know, groups and having meetings with other people who are going through a similar thing is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Sure, because all of that reality all at once, and here we go again with the stampede metaphor, all of that reality can crush you if you have not looked at it for so long and you've adjusted to an unreality. Now facing all of that could be such an enormous thing that it could flood, literally, actually, we're talking about the physiology of the nervous system, is that it's electrical impulses that we're talking about. And when these electrical impulses are minimized by the brain, the brain shuts off certain circuits so that there's a part of the brain that is literally isolated from electricity. Well, if you open up those circuits, now you have a flood of electricity that's too intense, and it threatens to burn off the neurons, the brain cells that are affected by it. So actually addiction is a protection against that. So yes, there is a way to do this, to come to terms with an addiction slowly, gently, and with the proper support. Because without that, the brain could be overwhelmed by electricity.
Well, we'll be overwhelmed, and if you're prepared for the overwhelm, you're fine. You know, if you think about it, when you say electricity, people use interchangeably electricity as a kind of metaphor for anxiety and anxiety as a metaphor for electricity. It is neurological discharge that we're dealing with.
Sure.
But there is anxiety is the original reason that we want to use compartmentalization. The reason that that people compartmentalize in general, we're going to talk about it societally later, but physically is because we can't function if we're too nervous. We
exactly.
just can't function. And I want to talk about three different kinds of anxiety. One is called normal anxiety or called reality anxiety. And this is the most basic form of anxiety and is based on fears of real and possible events, such as being bitten by a dog or falling down from a ladder or flooding or a hurricane, real stuff, mm-hmm. real stuff. Or
Being attacked. Mm-hmm.
The most common way of reducing tension from reality anxiety is removing oneself from the situation or refusing to go near certain situations. Like many people say, I'm going to live in the country because I don't want to live in the cities.
Mm.
Most common way. But compartmentalizing is one of the ways that people do it with reality nowadays, real anxiety. Then there's neurotic anxiety. And this is a form of anxiety that comes from an unconscious fear that the that something is going to happen.
Like an imagined disaster or like an imagined catastrophe.
And you know, it's a funny thing, Roberta. When these categories were put down, they talked about like an imagined disaster, hurricane, imagined flooding, imagined war, imagined attack by foreign invaders.
Oh, the UFOs, yes, the ETs.
No, but not even that, even terrorism in its own form. We would say, being afraid of that, aha.
Mm-hmm.
Being afraid of a flooding in New Orleans would have been considered a neurotic anxiety.
Sure.
It never happened. How could it happen?
Right.
You know, like the president said, how could we have ever anticipated that?
Right.
And then, I'm not going there, I'm
no,
sorry.
No, let's not go there.
And then there's the moral anxiety. Now, this is a real important one. Compartmentalization helps you deal with the moral anxiety, and that is if you have a conflict between what you know is right, a form of anxiety that comes from a fear of violating values and moral codes.
So that shows up as guilt?
Yeah, guilt and shame.
Mm.
When anxiety occurs, the mind first responds by kind of problem-solving, thinking, rational ways of escaping it, and then putting it into convenient compartments.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I knew a man recently who was promoted over his best friend who got him the job. And he was promoted. He was promoted to be a superior to his best friend who got him the job, who had been at this place for 10 years longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the man had to do something with his mind.
Sure. He had to compartmentalize.
He had to compartmentalize. He had to say to himself, well, so he goes to his friend and he says, is this okay with you? Or what do you expect your friend is going to say? Of course it's okay with me, but the friend was killed by it,
right,
not getting the promotion. And then you have to look at this and you have to say, I know my friend is really upset with it, but I'm going to compartmentalize. I'm going to put it in a convenient place in my brain where I'm going to make it okay to take the new job. And so he took the new job doing this. Eventually, of course, his friend quit the job because he was passed over.
So but he had to take his anxiety about this.
And the moral anxiety.
And he had to put it somewhere out of his consciousness.
And he put it away. He just said, we'll get a little box, we'll wrap this up, we'll put it over there. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it.
No, but the problem is it doesn't go away forever. You know, when you take the anxiety
if
you're
feeling, violate moral commitments.
Right, and you put it elsewhere so you don't have to deal with it, it seems that you might be able to put it away for good, but eventually it comes back because
well,
it doesn't leave completely.
What happens to us, Roberta, every time we pass a homeless person?
That's why I
you
brought
know what
up
I mean?
That example.
I know.
Because I can think of one person that I walk by every day, almost, when I get off the train, and she's always there. She's always there. That's where she lives, on the street. And I look at her, and sometimes I give her some money. Sometimes I buy her, you know, a coffee and orange juice. But I have to compartmentalize, because if I allowed myself to feel the real feelings I have, I couldn't go to work. I would have to sit there with this woman, and I would have to talk with her. What happened?
Nothing. A little engineering
That was sounded like nice music.
And it was nice. It said, don't tell me.
Right.
But it does remind me that we are about to take a short break. When we come back, a little special music, my friends. And then we'll come back with our discussion on compartmentalizing. He's moving.
Oh, sure.
I like to trip over those. We'll be right back.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
I love Al Lewis live, Saturdays at noon. Oh, yeah.
I'm Karen Lewis. I love my co-producer, Grandpa Al Lewis, together with
engineer Eliza Butler and you, the listeners.
We talk about politics, community, and social justice, things you can get passionate about. Al Lewis live,
Saturdays, noon to 1:30 p.m.
Get passionate about something. Oh, yeah.
C-A-M-I-E-L. Take me to this place. But I've never been before. Take me to this place, Camille. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. It is Wednesday here at WBAI. We are surprisingly on air with you. We thought there would be the hearings. So now we're being told that that may happen next week, almost for sure on Tuesday. But, you know, you just, you never know.
Right.
That's a very important statement, you never know. It's not at our station, you never know. You never know kind of what's going to happen next in this funny world we're living in. And so what happens is the brain becomes so used to shock and awe that you flip everything into a little compartment.
But what happens with the compartmentalization, when it's done to diminish anxiety level, even though it facilitates survival in the short term, and therefore it's effective and it's useful when, you know, when activated appropriately, when this is something that we do day in and day out, the cortisol levels in the brain stay chronically too high, and cortisol has a rather unpleasant effect on the brain, meaning that it causes death of neurons, brain cells, but especially with compartmentalization, it has been noticed that there's a shrinking of the hippocampus. The hippocampus is a part of the brain that's related to memory, storage, and retrieval.
Where is it?
It's in the middle of the brain.
The old hippocampus.
It's in the middle. I believe it's
sitting around the pineal gland.
In the brain stem, I think. It's one of the parts of the brains that works on its own, not through the activity of consciousness, but it's automatic or autonomic. But however, it is connected to consciousness by fibers, brain fibers, neurons. But the problem is when we compartmentalize, these fibers are kind of deactivated, and then slowly they kind of wither and atrophy. And this is how we lose memory. And then we go and try to remember something and we don't remember it. And that's because we've compartmentalized a bit too much.
Wow. So you know, Roberta, okay, so let's go back to this a little. I think what you're saying is very important. Part of what we want to understand is how does the world get by taking a look at such horrors and putting them in little convenient places in your mind, so that you're not so aware of the horrors that you go around shivering all day long, which I would. I do.
Right.
You know, now I don't watch television much. And as a result of not watching television much, I have not been inundated with the pictures from Louisiana, the photographs from Louisiana and the movies from Louisiana. You know, I haven't seen as much as all that, but I've heard and read about the tragedy of it. And when I read about it, tears come to my eyes immediately. So I turned on the TV to look. And as I looked, I noticed I was dry-eyed. And I said, there's something about the television phenomena that enables me to put this in a place that just because I'm seeing it, I have a convenient place to put it. Tragedy. You know, like it's like a movie.
Right.
It's like something that Hollywood produced.
That's because you've been to the movies and you've watched TV enough that you've had a chance to develop that program, so that when you see something on the screen, let's say you're at the movies and you're watching a movie and there's a tragedy in that movie, you're able to know that that's not true, and you're able not to grieve over it. But the problem is now you have a place where you can put even the real stuff and go numb about even the real stuff.
I think about some of these games that children play where you blow off the head of somebody, or, you know, even some of the movies that are out there, the more gruesome the better, where somebody gets shot and they fall down and they die, and then the guy gets up and he walks over these bodies and walks away, and then you watch a news report where there's a dead person. who is shot or killed or something, and it's like you've just watched another crime scene movie. You right. haven't seen anything any different. So the compartment is formed
right.
for video viewing of tragedy. That's why we could have watched right back to the Vietnam War. We were able to watch horrors and put them in a place that stopped us from reacting.
Right.
It's like the more coverage, the more numb we got.
Right. Well, that's exactly what compartmentalization does. And if you think about it, Armand, it's very important to be able to do that, because sometimes it's necessary, you know, and it's a very important survival dynamic that we need to have. It's just that because of, you know, the fact that it's been exploited, well, I'm not going to get into the judgmental part, but because of the way we're so used to seeing these things and not reacting to them, we don't react even when they're real. And that's okay, so that's okay. I mean, I don't want to judge that either. But we do need to be aware of the fact that that anxiety doesn't completely go away, and it may be aroused at a time when, you know, it may cause a stampede or a panic attack or something, and then we can't figure out, why am I experiencing a panic attack? There's nothing right now around me to justify that. Well, it may be that it's the panic that I could have felt a week ago when I watched television, but I didn't because it was compartmentalized back then. So I'm feeling it now instead.
A lot of that's a very interesting thing you're saying, because a lot of panic attacks and sleep terrors, night terrors, could easily be the accumulation of anxiety that's been suppressed through compartmentalization. So here's what I propose, my friends. I propose that if you watch a movie where somebody is killed, or that somebody is a movie and it's a movie production, that you don't weep at the movie. But I propose that if it's reality, you do weep. And that somehow you separate in your mind the difference between movies and reality. I propose that you do it actively with yourself. I say, if you're looking at that on television, like, I know people who could watch TV and be so engrossed as if it is real. And then they will cry and they'll say, oh, Michael just died and he... You
now,
know.
That's the other part of it, that then we end up reacting to soap operas.
And discharging, you see?
And discharging right.
some of that built-up
right.
stuff.
Right.
Let me go back to your cortisol theory for a moment, mm-hmm. okay, to the belief in cortisol, because this is really...
The hippocampus?
The hippocampus,
mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you, in some way, cut off the mechanisms... You then sever some of the memory functions that we have.
Right.
By compartmentalizing, you could eventually sever some of your own memory functions, but just think about how fortunate that is to not remember.
Convenient,
because,
you mean?
Yes, convenient, because think about how if you lose a child
right.
and you compartmentalize it.
Well, sure, all defenses... really have a good reason to be. They facilitate survival, and we need them, and they in a healthy individual, these defenses are, these protective dynamics are activated to allow the person to cope with unforeseen events that may be very difficult, and to cope with them by separating the part of the self that deals with that event with the rest of the self. So that's great. That's a great survival strategy, and I applaud it. I think that what we're witnessing at this time with the situation in Louisiana, or even when 9/11 happened, whenever we are confronted with a tragedy that could have been prevented... Because of compartmentalization, I think, it becomes maybe easy to compartmentalize feelings or thoughts that perhaps might be worthwhile to be paid attention to and to be heeded rather than compartmentalized.
We live with a government that can do everything that it is doing based on what they understand is the ability of the American people to compartmentalize.
Absolutely. That's what I was trying
to say. You just couldn't get away with it.
Right.
You couldn't get away with poverty in the streets. You couldn't get away with, you know, people dying in their attics in Louisiana because they couldn't get help. You couldn't get away with unnecessary war and soldiers dying. You can't get away with hiding the caskets so that the American people don't see it. You can't get away with that unless you have an American mind that is willing to collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine. I mean, if you think that this is, I mean, I certainly am not saying the government is fine, but I am saying that if this is one of our mechanisms, fine. If it truly worked, it would be great. If only it didn't come up and bite you in the butt at some later time, which is what it always does.
But see, Armand, I applaud you for doing this program and addressing this, because no one's talking about this. I haven't heard anyone bring up this compartmentalization issue, but it's very important that people are aware that this is what we do. And as I was saying before, we need to do it up to a point, or else we wouldn't be able to function. Everything would just collapse, especially in a world like ours where things are so difficult. Because, Armand, let's face it, I mean, it's not a pretty social picture that we live in. So we need to compartmentalize. But when you come on the air and teach people that this is what we're doing and explain to them why this dynamic is there and explain to us how can we use it to our advantage and how can we perhaps be selective when we don't want to apply it, use it, I think that's doing people a great favor, because from knowing, for me at least, from knowing that this is something I'm able to do, I now feel like, well, perhaps I don't have to compartmentalize unless I want to. You know what I mean? It gives me a position of choice that I did not have before when I did not know that that's what my mind can do. And the thing you're saying about the fact that it comes back and bites your, what did you call it?
It bites you in the butt,
in
is
the
what
butt.
I said, so I wouldn't be taken off the air.
Right. It bites you in the butt. That's also very important, because it tells us, hey, the body doesn't just forget like the mind does. The body has a way of keeping memories in the tissues, in the organs, in the functions. So what do we want to store and what do we want to keep in front of us?
You know, the object of terrorism is to induce terror. Induce it not so that people are always reacting, but induce it so that people don't feel safe. American people currently are feeling safe, many of them protected behind their new homes that they bought with the low interest rates. But everybody is vulnerable. Everybody who is denied the reality is vulnerable. Everybody who is there. If a thing hits, if a thing would have surprisingly hit, you'd get a new level of compartmentalization. But if it hits again and again, it'll break down.
Right.
It'll break down. I mean, it'll break down to the point. Do you know what saves us? It reminds me of the photograph of the Nazis marching through France. And they show this older man. He must have been 60 years old with a mustache. And I know this photograph. Where you see the Nazi soldiers marching down the Champs-Élysées. And you look at him and he's got a tear in his eye.
Mm.
What saves us is our tears.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't shed a tear for what's happening in reality, but can only shed a tear, like people say, I say to people very often, when's the last time you cried? Oh, I cry in the movies all the time.
Mm.
No, cry in reality.
Yeah.
Let your tears come to you in reality. Let your love come to you in reality. Don't just love, you know, the movie screen, the TV screen. Try to get it to happen in reality. If it can't happen, then that's something to work on. Mm. Then get to work on it. Go to psychotherapy. Blast it open. Find out what's taking place in there and do what you would do if you would challenge any addiction. Because in a way, you know, compartmentalizing becomes an addiction.
Well, sure. I mean, that's what it's for, in the sense that it allows us to. That's true with every defense, both physical as well as mental. It'll work up to a point, and eventually, once it reaches a level where the defense can no longer protect us, everything that we've defended against has now reached enormous proportions and hits us on the head with a tremendous force. But if we are willing to confront what we're protecting ourselves from mentally and physically before it gets to that point, and it requires being willing to cry, it requires being willing to suffer, but it requires being willing to experience compassion. Compassion means come with passion, emotional intensity, to feel with other people, to feel what they're feeling, to go through life with them and not isolated in a cocoon of protected artificial reality. To live with reality is really the best protection in the end.
You know, you think about our soldiers that we send into war with trained compartmentalization.
Oh, yeah, that's...
I mean, just think of what we do with death and fear. You know, killing, fear, and then they come back. What do you do with these? What do you do with this poor mind that has just had 2 years of this this kind of mentality? And what happens is they come back and they can't cry. There's not a tear left.
That's the cortisol. Cortisol, that's exactly what cortisol does. It burns the nervous fibers in such a way that then that person is numb. And if you can increase the cortisol levels to the point where it burns off certain connections, yes, you're not able to cry because you no longer have access to the part of you that can feel empathy, sadness. So we're really talking about the making of a psychopath. When we are to make a psychopath, how do you make a psychopath? You take a person and you stress them enough that the cortisol levels are now so high that you take away their ability to feel with their hearts, to feel compassion and empathy, to feel for another and with another. Those connections are not there. There's psychopathy. Well, that's, I believe, what happens to people who are sent out to war like that. They need to be trained in this way in order for them to be able to do what they do. But then when they come back, how do they fit in with their families and friends and with a regular life where you do need to feel?
Well, I believe, you know, Roberta, that the human spirit is going to come through this. And I believe that we've just, you know, we've compartmentalized as far as we can. But I have seen such compassion for Louisiana and the responses. I mean, there was a truck leaving, going through Manhattan today, saying on the way to New Orleans, you know, picking up anything possible. And I don't know if it was a legitimate truck or just some guy with a truck. But it was clear, you know, there is so many efforts coming from so many parts of the world going into Louisiana. And by the way, you know, I talked about the French sympathy for what took place in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, that was a French city.
Yeah.
You know, it's originally part of their home in America. It's part of what they felt was their home in America.
Right.
So there's a great loss to them. But the human spirit is not going to take it for too long. You cannot keep pressing it down, because there's enough of you out there who refuse to go dead. Enough of you who refuse to go numb.
Especially in the WBAI audience, I think we have people who refuse to be compartmentalized.
But the trouble with them is very often they intellectualize, even our audience just intellectualizes and thinking, well, I will not be afraid. No, my friends, no. Be afraid. Feel fear, feel wonder, feel joy, feel scared, you know.
And feel sad.
And feel love. This is Armando Bill with Romita.
There we go. Romita.
Romita.
I like that.
Romita Maria Hatti. Hey, you're on your way to Italy, right?
I am.
They must be listening to us right now.
Mm-hmm.
Are they listening?
They
are. Your sister listening to our program today?
They do.
You can get this program as an archive just by tuning into WBAI.org. You'll find the archives at WBAI.org, or you can go to the website, thepositivemind.com. Listen to this program and dozens of other programs that we have recorded in our archives, as well as plenty of good information and especially a wonderful cartoon. If you want to reach Roberta,
www.creativehealthsolutions.org. Make sure you put that S at the end.
Oh, that's what I did wrong. And if you want a copy of today's program, you would call 212-757-4488. Be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.
And you are tuned to listener-supported, commercial-free, community radio WBAI, WBAI.org, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Coming up at 2 p.m., Light Show with a special guest host. Do stay tuned. Talk back with Hugh Hamilton at 3 p.m.
Pacifica Headline News, I'm Verna Avery Brown. Here's what's happening in the news. According to his ex-wife, American contractor Roy Hallams is free. The 57-year-old had been missing since November 1, 2004, after being seized with two other foreigners in Iraq. Susan Hallams said she can confirm Hallams' release and that he is in good condition. Hallams working for a catering company when he was taken during a gun battle in Mansour, Iraq last year. An Iraqi guard and one attacker were killed at the time. Hurricane Katrina will reduce employment by 400,000 people in coming months while trimming economic growth by as much as a full percentage point in the second half of the year. That's according to a Congressional Budget Office assessment. USA Today is reporting that later today an announcement is expected that the federal government will issue $2,000 debit cards to adult victims of the hurricane. According to a state official interviewed by the Associated Press, the cards may be used for food, transportation, gas, and other essentials the displaced people need. The report came as police continued helping residents who wanted to be rescued from the city. By midday today, there were no reports of forced evacuations despite Mayor Ray Nagin's instructions to officers to remove holdouts for their own safety. Bill Quigley, a law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, recalls the countless acts of heroism he personally witnessed during the catastrophe.
Every minute there were acts of heroism. We could see people going down the... We saw two black guys pushing an elderly white person in a boat one day down the street. The street had probably 8 feet of water. Another day we'd see two white guys pushing an elderly black woman in a canoe down the water. I mean, you know, trying to bring her to higher ground. People were swimming, trying to bring water to a Salvation Army home that we could see from where we were, where kids were there.
Bill Quigley speaking on Pacifica's What's at Stake. Mayor Nagin's directive, which superseded an earlier milder order to evacuate made before Hurricane Katrina crashed ashore August 29th, came after rescuers scouring New Orleans found hundreds of people ignoring warnings to get out. Some residents are being evacuated to small towns outside of Houston, Texas. Akua Halt, a grassroots activist in the Houston area, says some are being sent to the small town of Tyler, Texas, and they may experience culture shock upon arrival.
Tyler, Texas is a dry county, and it's also a county or a area that's very segregated. And, you know, New Orleans, because of the fact that it's a tourist town, they're used to mixing and mingling with all kinds of people. And the other thing is, yes, you know, it's known as the Big Easy, the party town. And Tyler, Texas, you know, as I said before, it is a dry county. And unfortunately, we realize that many of the people will have psychological issues that they're dealing with, and we hope that when they go to these counties, that there's enough intervention and support to assist them in getting the care that they need.
Akua Holt, grassroots activist in the Houston area. Members of the U.S. Senate paid their last respects to William H. Rehnquist today, praising him as one of the nation's finest chief justices and a leader who oversaw the Supreme Court's work with dignity and dispatch. He kept the members of the court together despite their many differences, said Senator George Voinovich, a Republican from Ohio. Pete Domenici, a Republican from New Mexico, called Rehnquist a great intellect who matured tremendously during more than three decades on the court. The senators walked across the street from the Capitol to the Supreme Court's Great Hall, where Rehnquist's body lay in repose before funeral services for the Chief Justice were to begin at the historic St. Matthew's Cathedral. President Bush and Supreme Court Justice Sandra...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.